Different members will be asking you different questions. Please just feel relaxed. We're here to encourage you to tell us a little bit more about yourself, and how you respond to the questions will also assist us. Thank you very much. So let's start off by briefly, Mr. Humer, if you could give us and share with us your past experience and also indicate the contribution in the light of that as to what you would make to the Commission. What would be your contribution to the Commission? And what, in your own opinion, would be the main criteria for the chairperson? So the first thing is, using your past experience, tell us how that will relate to what contribution you'll make in the Commission. And then secondly, in your opinion, what is the main criteria for the chairperson? Go ahead, when you're ready, just press the button. That perhaps I was remiss. We have here the Honourable Jerome van Schalkwyk, the Honourable Arumo Kalako, the whip of the committee sitting next to her. Then we have the Honourable Dean MacPherson sitting at the back there. And to his left, the Honourable Jordan Hill Lewis. Thank you. So go ahead.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members of the Committee. As stated, my name is William Elias Humer. As far as my past experience is concerned and how it will contribute to the National Lotteries Commission, I am trained as a lawyer with degrees BProc, LLB, and Masters in Law, and I completed my coursework cum laude for the doctoral degree of law, and thereafter I got interested in corporate governance and the general business world, where I did a diploma in corporate governance with Henley Management and a number of other certificates in financial management, organization design, culture change, performance management, project management, and also other competency-based certificates. My training initially as a lawyer has helped me to be able to be analytical, to be able to make a contribution of a different nature, in the sense that as a lawyer you're expected to uphold the highest standards of ethics, morality, and integrity. And also my experience in the business world has taught me also to be an ethical leader, in the sense that you have to give leadership, you have to give direction, and you have to oversee the attainment of the goals and objectives of the institution, and also foster teamwork. I have enormous experience in the country and outside the country. I have worked outside the country for Accenture, which is an international technology and management consulting firm listed in the New York Stock Exchange. I was among the founding partners, originally were 12 worldwide. 1,200 worldwide, 12 in South Africa, and I have distinguished myself by also being able to sit in the regional EXCO for EMEA, Europe, Middle East, and Africa, where I was a partner responsible for competencies. That is a significant achievement, being a South African in a And locally, I have also served in a number of organizations, including Group 5, including a number of technology and management consulting firms. And at the moment, I'm also chairing a number of trust and other boards, including amongst notable ones is the Lanseria Airport, as well as the National Lotteries Participant Trust, which is a trust specifically created to look at the interest of participants in the national lotteries. So I think, firstly, to sum up my past experience, how relevant it is to this position, as a chairperson of the National Lotteries Participant Trust, I've had exposure to the operations functioning of the National Lotteries Commission, because the trust is accountable to the commission for its operations, and it plays a very important role. And secondly, in my about 5 or 6 years ago, I assisted the National Lotteries Commission to reposition itself. You would remember that almost 6 to 5 years ago, the commission had numerous problems, and I was then a partner of a management consulting firm, and I was specifically asked in that capacity to come and facilitate and assist the commission with a new strategy, a new annual performance plan, and how to align this to the budget of the commission. So I'm not a stranger. I understand the workings and the functions of the commission. Then it was called the board, but now it's called the commission. And I think you will agree with me, members of the committee, for the last 5 years, the commission has done much better than it did previously. And it is this input that I made in repositioning the commission that has assisted. And I am convinced that should I be successful, I will lead the commission into the next phase of repositioning. And I'll talk more about how I intend repositioning the commission later if I'm given the opportunity.
You will be, Mr. Humer. Just one thing then, you know, the main criteria, just give it to me as three, the top three issues.
Yes. I think the chairperson should be a leader. Should be able to direct, should be able to foster teamwork, should lead ethically, must be very ethical in his leadership. And integrity is very important as well.
Thank you very much, Mr. Humer, for sharing that with us. And we'll then move on to our next question.
Thank you very much, Mr. Humer. I need to ask you what do you envisage as the main functions of the National Lotteries Commission?
The main functions of the Lotteries Commission are summed up in three categories. The first category are the functions that relate to advising the Minister of Trade and Industry. There's 5 of them. The second category are those functions that relating to ensuring that specific things happen within the Commission, and there are 3 of them. The third category are those related to administering the institution, and there's 2 of them, and I'll come back to all of them. The last 3 are miscellaneous, relating to 3 different things. Let me start with the ones that relate to advising the minister. 1, the commission is expected to advise the minister on the issuing of the license to conduct the national lottery. 2, advise the minister on the percentage of monies to be allocated in terms of Section 26(3). 3, advise the Minister on the efficacy of legislation pertaining to lotteries and ancillary matters. 4, advising the Minister on the establishment and implementing of a social responsibility program in respect of the national lotteries. 5, advise the Minister on any matter relating to the national lottery and other lotteries, as well as on any matter in respect of which the Minister may require advice from the board. That's the 5 that relates to the advising of the Minister. Now, those that relate to ensuring that the board do certain things are the following 3. The board is expected to ensure that the national lotteries and sports pools are conducted with all due propriety and integrity. Secondly, that the interests of every participant in the national lottery are adequately protected. Thirdly, that the net profits of the national lotteries are as large as possible. In other words, increasing the cake and ensuring sustainability. The 3rd category relating to administering the institution are the following. Administer the National Lotteries Distribution Trust Fund as well as holding it in trust. In other words, the board members are also trustees of the National Lotteries Distribution Trust Fund. Secondly, administering and investing monies that are paid to the National Lotteries Commission in accordance with the Lotteries Act. The last miscellaneous 3 relate to monitoring, regulating, and policing the lotteries. Secondly, performing such additional duties in respect of the lotteries as the Minister may assign to the board from time to time. And the last one is making arrangements as may be specified in the license conditions with regard to prize monies and the sums that needs to be distributed to the distributing agencies. In other words, those funds have to be preserved and secured in accordance with the conditions that are specified in the license agreement. These are, in a nutshell, the main functions and mandate of the board of the National Lotteries Commission.
One of the functions of the Commission is to advise the Minister on the efficacy of the current legislation. In your opinion, what are some of the challenges in the implementation of the legislation? Are there any areas or issues that you maintain should be brought to the immediate attention of the Minister?
Thank you for the question. Advising the Minister on the efficacy of the current legislation would involve, in my opinion, analyzing the shortcomings of the current legislation. And I have observed the following shortcomings. Firstly, there's illegal lotteries in the market space. Secondly, bookmakers are not regulated at this point in time. Society lotteries and other lotteries, online lotteries, are not regulated as well. There is also online playing, online lotteries, which are not adequately regulated. And I think the legislation needs to be reviewed to accommodate the regulating of bookmakers, society lotteries, the clamping down on illegal lotteries because of the loss of revenue from that side, and also on the other lotteries that I've mentioned earlier. But more importantly, also in terms of the rules that needs to be promulgated to ensure that the changes are effective, it's really aligning the grant-making processes with the objectives of the Act, and also ensuring that there are mechanisms put in place to ensure timely grant-making or distribution of the funds. At the moment, the period is adequate, but if it can be changed to make the turnaround better. If you look at the financial year and the period that is allocated, it means almost 4 to 5 months elapses before you could distribute the funds. I think these are the key observations that I've made for myself.
If you would put your mic off at the moment, Mr. Humer, we then go on to the Honourable Kalako's question.
When advising the Minister on the allocations of the various categories, what factors will you take into consideration?
I think it's important to take into account the following factors. One, the revenue derived from each province is very critical. For instance, if one province accounts for a particular percentage of the revenue, that needs to be taken into account, firstly. Secondly, the state of the economy in that particular province is very important. There are certain areas of our country that are very depressed economically, where there's poverty, there's unemployment, and so forth. The third criteria should be the percentage of the population that needs the kind of support that the NLC provides. And the one that comes to my mind, which is not really provided for in the Act, is it's really focusing more and more on the rural and the poor in the villages, simply because they cannot put the applications successfully because of the illiteracy levels, the lack of infrastructure, and the knowledge of how the institution works. So that will assist in alleviating poverty and deprivation in the rural communities. I mean, if you look at most of the grants that have been allocated to date, even though more may be in the so-called rural provinces, but they go still in the towns and cities of those rural provinces. Those allocations do not go to where they are needed most, which is the villages. So something needs to be done by redirecting the funds to the villages. But also when you give it to the villages, we should look at the concept of social entrepreneurship. We do not become another SASA, just grant making. We need to look at social entrepreneurship, funds or allocations that will empower the community to create sustainable livelihoods for themselves. I've seen this concept recently when I visited Botswana. The government of Botswana is giving more money to communities in rural villages to sustain themselves so that they become less and less dependent on the state. It's called social entrepreneurship. And this, and the other part that I think is very important is its cooperation and partnership between the NLC and other funders. For instance, I have also observed double dipping in the system. So if the NLC partners with other government grant-making institutions to focus more on social entrepreneurship, we could go a long way to alleviating poverty in the country.
Thank you. very much. We then move on to a question from the Honourable Van Schalkwyk.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, Mr. Jonge. Or I should rather say, goeiemôre. Want ek sien u is, u kan u self excellent uitdruk in baie tale. So, my question to you is, if governance challenges were to arise between the National Lotteries Commission and the distributing agencies, how would you address these challenges? Thank you.
I think one of the cardinal principles of corporate governance is that the board should be able to manage stakeholders. You have different stakeholders in this institution, and one of the immediate and key stakeholders is the distributing agencies. Provision has been made in terms of the Lotteries Amendment Act that the distributing agencies should have full-time members who are now employees of the Commission and they are occupying space within the premises. So I would create a subcommittee of the board, which I would want the chair of the board to be in charge of, to ensure that on a quarterly basis, the board and the distributing agencies have regular meetings to be able to discuss areas of concern or areas of dissatisfaction so that they are resolved timely. And I would ensure that there's a proper board committee charter which defines the roles and responsibilities of this committee. And I would invite the chairperson and deputy chairperson of the distributing agencies and all the members of the board to participate in that board committee.
You have a follow-up on Alban Scott-Beck? Thank you, Mr. Humer. We have the Honourable Niall McPherson, and we're moving into the, you know, trying to get an understanding from you what you think of leadership, your understanding of leadership, Honourable McPherson.
Mr. Humer, what experience do you currently have in terms of board memberships or senior level management?
I have vast experience, and I'll try and go back and trace my experience to when I first started working. I have been a manager at a number of organizations, promoted to senior management, and became an executive. As I previously alluded, I was a partner is a leader in an institution at a global level. And currently, I chair the BDH Trust. I'm the CEO of the BDH Group, which is a holding company with about 7 subsidiaries. I'm on the board of the Lanseria Airport. I'm on the board of the NLC. I'm the chairperson of the Audit and Risk Committee of the Office of the Chief Justice. I chair the Audit and Risk Committee of the National Department of Health. I also chair the Audit and Risk Committee of the Department of Public Service and Administration. And I think among the few that I've mentioned will demonstrate my leadership. And I've served in those institutions as chairperson of the Audit and Risk Committees, as chairpersons of boards, as chairpersons of trust. And this has not just come overnight. It's because I've got a very long, illustrious career, starting as a law lecturer at the University of the North and West University, moving into the private sector, KUC, Group 5, and many others, moving into executive management, and ending up in boards and trust as an ordinary board member or trustee, and also now as chairperson of a number of those institutions. And I've been adequately trained. I'm not just in those positions by growth or time. I have attended numerous training that prepared me significantly for a leadership position. One kind of a training is the leadership I got at Henley Management School in the UK about corporate governance. It includes governance, compliance, risk management, financial management, strategic management, and Accenture had its own university in Chicago and at Oxford. It owns 25% of Oxford University, and its partners were compelled to regularly go for training at Oxford and at St. Charles in Chicago. So they made sure that by the time you become partner, you're fully trained and you can appreciate your leadership position and you can make a proper, meaningful contribution. So I have risen through the ranks, progressing to where I am, but that was underpinned by proper training and leadership, being prepared to take a proper role.
Do you have another question on the I just wanted you very briefly to give me the number of boards you're sitting on.
The first one is the NS, or the number. About four. I am excluding audit and risk committees.
Important, they take a lot of time. So it's five altogether,
yes.
Then? Yes, five boards. I thought as much, thank you. I have to take the Honourable Hildius, then I'm going to take the Honourable Kalaka.
Thank you, sir. You obviously have vast experience. I want to check, what does the BDH group do? Is it the chemicals group?
No, it's not in the chemical. It's got investment in the pharmaceutical industry. It's in property, and it's in financial management.
And I presume you would be prepared to resign as the Chief Executive Officer were you appointed?
My time is up already. I'm being pushed out.
Oh dear.
In fact, at the end of no, not really, because you need to give the young people more creative. At the end of June, at the shareholders meeting, the successor has already been appointed. I'll be stepping down.
Thank you.
And it's willingly. I appreciate it because the young people need to be given chance and space.
Let me just come to the Honourable Kalaka, please.
No, Chair, for me it's a similar question. Due to the fact that you are in many boards and chairing many boards, will you have time to devote your time in? If you are appointed, will you be able, with all these responsibilities in other boards, to devote your time?
I thank you very much for the question, and I think I had omitted to explain that a lot of these positions are coming to an end. There are 3-year term appointments. The office, the National Department of Health, my term is up. The DPSA, my term is up. And many of the other private sector ones are also up. I would not have made myself available for a further board position if I knew I don't have the time. I take my responsibilities extremely serious, and I would want to make a contribution, just not add numbers behind my name. And also, the audit and risk committees meet once a quarter. And the responsibilities are really to look at the annual financial statements and the annual performance reports or the quarterly performance reports. And those are prepared by management, overseen by the minister. By the time they come to us, really, it's spending about 3 hours in a day. That's not much. They're not demanding. No, not at all. They're not like the boards. The boards are more demanding. The audit and risk committee is more of an oversight committee looking at risk and financial management.
Thank you very much. Mr. Humer, we have the Honourable Van Schalkwyk again.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Mr. Humer, how do you understand the difference between the roles of the Commissioner and the Board, and what is the relationship between the Board, the Minister, and Parliament? Thank you.
a good one. Because all these people have to work together to make the institution more successful. There's a lot of interdependencies. The commissioner is an executive functionary of the commission. He or she is responsible for the full administrative, executive, and other functions of the commission. And he or she accounts for the full functions of the commission to the board of the NLC, and he gets directions and guidance from the board to implement its strategy and the APP or annual performance plan as well as the budget. Now in turn the board provides leadership, guidance and directs the activities of the commission and ensuring that the medium-term strategic framework is realized and achieved through the strategic plan in the APP, and also reports to the executive authority. The board is the accounting authority, and the minister is the executive authority. He or she is in charge of that institution. The buck stops with the minister politically, so you have to account to the minister and the board. But also very important, the minister is held accountable by Parliament through its portfolio committee for the functioning of the institution. And therefore, the board will assist the minister in ensuring that the institution is governed correctly and accounts for its finances and performance to the committee, this committee. So I would expect that on a quarterly basis, the NLC is invited to the committee, the portfolio committee, to account for its performance, obviously with the CEO or CEO, to ensure that the annual performance plan responsibilities are executed and full accountability is given to this committee. So there's a very good relationship. I think the governance model is very straightforward. Everybody accounts to somebody, and there's a structured mechanism of accounting because the commissioner has a strategic plan, it's got the APP, and it's got the budget. He or she needs to account to the board in respect of all of those. The board must account to the minister. The minister must account in respect of the three to the parliament. Also, the commission accounts directly to parliament whenever they are required to come to parliament and account. So all four needs to work together to ensure a well-functioning, accountable institution.
Thank you. Do you want to follow up on this question?
Right.
We then move on to the Honourable Hill Lewis.
Thank you, Mr. Huber. Briefly, sir, what would you identify as your five-year strategic objectives or priorities for the Commission were you to be appointed the Chairman? And secondly, what systems or processes would you implement to monitor the progress made in achieving those strategic objectives?
Thank you, Honourable Member. Let me, before I outline my key strategic objectives for the next 5 years, let me start with the challenges that I have observed to date, and therefore they will link very well with why I have these strategic objectives in mind for the next 5 years. The challenges that I've noted, and these are based on my own personal analysis of the annual report of the institution, because I've been tracking how well the institution is doing since I last facilitated their strategic plan. The first one is illegal lotteries. And in my five-year plan or strategic objectives, I would like to address the issue of illegal lotteries. The second one is fraud, and that manifests itself in the form of double dipping. In other words, you apply to the national lotteries, you apply to Arts and Culture, you apply to DTI itself, you apply to whatever other institution for the same. The third one is misalignment of grant allocation processes. If these processes are engineered, we'll deliver faster, we'll deliver much faster. The fourth one is non-compliance with the prescribed time frames. The fifth one is information management and information security. The last one is participant protection. Participant protection in the form of unsecured online playing. Confidentiality is a big issue. And excessive playing. No one monitors excessive playing. You know, I can play the lotto every time and deplete the resources of the family, and no one is looking at that. And also underage play. No one knows if kids of 8 years, 10 years are playing. They could be playing. You give them money, pocket money for school, they save it to play the lotto. So it's another area that we need to look at. Now let me turn to my 5 years strategic objectives. And of course, this I have to sell hard to my fellow board members and executive management. It's just my narrow view of what I think needs to be done. Firstly, to reposition the NLC as a regulator. At the moment, the roles of the NLC are confused. On the one hand, the NLC is the regulator. On the other, is a grant-making institution through the distributing agencies. Focuses on the applications are processed, grants are made to the beneficiaries. So there's a dual mandate. And I really like the question that I was asked about the efficacy of the current legislation. Because the current legislation has created by default dual mandate. And if you look at the UK model, it's slightly different from us, and a lot could be learned from the UK model. I know ours is maturing, but as we mature, we can also look at the UK model. So that's repositioning. It's very important. As a regulator, we're not doing very well because there are illegal lotteries. We're also not regulating bookmakers, society, lotteries, and other forms of lotteries. A good example is, to what extent are we regulating online lotteries? I don't think we are regulating them adequately. Let me turn to the second area that I would like to focus on for the next 5 years if I'm successful. I would gradually like to focus the NLC towards social entrepreneurship. And I spoke about social entrepreneurship earlier. And in this regard, I would like to see increased social impact as well as high visibility of our projects, which has to leave a lasting legacy. But more importantly, to achieve social entrepreneurship, we will have to partner with other government institutions which are facilitating grant making. Thirdly, as I said earlier, I would like to focus on rural areas. I'm not meaning by any way to say that urban centers would not receive any assistance, but I would like to focus in rural areas, particularly the village people who have no other means of attaining funds. And I think they are at a disadvantage because of the levels of education, poor technology infrastructure, accessibility to infrastructure, and so forth. And this will assist NLC to have a better footprint. And then the fourth one is to explore further measures to make the NLC sustainable and grow its revenue. And by implication, it touches on the first one, because if you want to maximize your revenue, you've got to fulfill your responsibility of regulation. Society lotteries are not regulated. Bookmakers are not regulated. Online playing is not fully regulated. So by regulating all of this, it increases your revenue because they're all regulated and they have to pay something into your coffers. And the fifth one is developing strategies in preparation for the next licensing process. My own observations as I was reading the papers, I got the impression that we start very late in preparation for the next license. So you need to work on it and appreciate the risks around the preparations for this license. And then the last one is increasing focus on enforcement. As it stands now, the National Lotteries Commission does not have enforcement powers. And this will be part of advising the minister in reviewing the legislation. Enforcement powers, regulation without enforcement cannot be successful. If you look at the Financial Services Board and many others, it has enforcement powers. They can investigate, impose penalties on the financial institutions they are regulating. But the NLC is regulating without enforcement powers. These are the six key focus areas that I would like to translate into strategic objectives for the next 5 years. The rest of the organization is functioning very well. I mean, if you look at the clean audit, I've gone through the financial statements, I've looked at the annual report, AG report, it seems everything is going fine. There are just these minor little areas that needs to be attended to.
Sure. All right, thank you very much. Do you have a follow-up? Right. We then move on to the Honourable MacPherson.
Mr. Hume, how would you ensure that realistic targets for the commissioner are set and that his or her performance is measured accurately?
Can you please repeat the latter part?
How would you ensure that realistic targets for the commissioner are set and that his or her performance is measured accurately?
I think the start with compiling a performance agreement of the commission is first analyzing the 5-year strategic plan and the 1-year operational plan. Now, bear in mind the annual operational plan is a tool for implementing the strategic plan on an annual incremental basis. So I would take the annual performance plan, KPIs and targets, and cascade them into the commissioner's performance agreements. In other words, those KPIs and targets that are in the APP have to be exactly the same in the commissioner's performance agreement. So as we measure the performance of the institution, we are primarily measuring the performance of the commissioner. And the Public Service Act and the regulations makes provision that all public servants should be evaluated in terms of their performance twice per annum. The first evaluation is a biannual evaluation, which is done and recorded, and the last one is an annual evaluation which may result in performance rewards depending whether you have performed. So primarily I would take the KPIs, the targets in the APP, put them in the commissioner's performance contracts, and on a quarterly basis when the commissioner prepares performance information, quarterly reports to the board, which ultimately ends up in this committee, they will be that sync. So that if, for instance, the department records a poor performance, say, of 45% for the quarter, then it immediately reflects on the commissioner. The commissioner should be getting the same because you have cascaded. There is a sync. There's a link between the organizational KPIs and targets with those of the individual commissioner. So on a quarterly basis, we monitor them. On a biannual basis, the Public Service Act performance evaluation mechanisms kick in, and on an annual basis, after the annual performance report has been prepared and the Auditor General has audited the annual performance report, then we assess the commission. What is said about the performance of the organization will be said about the performance of the commission. And the commissioner also has to cascade his saw her KPIs and targets into the executives so that everybody else works towards the common goal. There will be a KPI on finance, on operations, on grant making, on everything else. And those cascaded to the lower levels so that we focus on common goals and objectives.
Thank you very much. Do you want to follow up, Honourable McPherson? Honourable Kalaku.
Thank you, Chair. How would you ensure that the discretionary fund is utilized in a balanced manner to promote community, that is community development, and be utilized in a sustainable manner?
Well, I think it's important to create a framework, a policy framework around any discretionary fund to ensure that as you disperse funds in terms of a discretionary fund, there is a policy framework that guides us to disperse those funds. And we should stick to those policy guidelines, and it should be audited both by internal audit and external audit to ensure that the funds are not abused or are not dispersed for unintended purposes. But also in terms of ensuring that the oversight of those funds is created properly with the adequate skills of a balanced nature to ensure that they are done correctly. But more importantly also, these are the funds that we should achieve high impact, high visibility, and must go to the poor of the poorest, so that the Commission's creation and establishment can be felt in the country. So in a nutshell, is policy framework that guides how these grants, discretionary grants, are allocated. It's oversight on the grants by a multidisciplinary team. Thirdly, it's auditing by both internal audit on a quarterly basis and on an annual basis, the Auditor General. And fourthly, is to ensure that there are clear goals for which these discretionary grants are geared or are intended to achieve, and then we should be able to function properly.
Do you have a follow-up for that, Honourable Kalaku? Because I see that that's the community development area, isn't it? Am I right? Do you have a follow-up, anyone?
So, with your permission, I want to emphasize the fact that because they are community development funds, we have to have very clear goals of what we want to achieve. In other words, we specify what community development projects we want to do, what are these projects going to achieve, and what is the likely impact of these projects in those communities, and are they visible enough to leave a mark, a legacy for the National Lotteries Commission. Those are the important criteria for me in allocating those funds to those community development projects.
Thank you, Mr. Huma. I just want to check with the Honourable Kalaku, because there were two questions there, but in some ways you appear to have conflated some of our points. Do you want to just ask another question in that regard, Honourable Kalaku?
One other question, which I think is related on this also, is what strategies do you think the Commission should implement in order to assess the impact of the funds dispersed, that they are utilized correctly. They are not misused, or they are not, as it often happens in other cases, that those funds are consumed in administration, paying of salaries in particular.
I think, firstly, there needs to be a monitoring and evaluation framework. Now, once you've set out, there's a basic principle about a 70-30 split with government funds. So, in other words, 70% of the funds must be used for operational purposes, achieving your strategy and your APP. 30% should be able to go to personnel expenditure. So if you stick to that principle, then you know the funds that are collected are utilized for the intended purposes. Now, with the disbursements of funds and the operational expenditure, you need to ensure that the goals and the objectives that are in, one, the annual performance plan are achieved by utilization of the budget. Or in the case of the distributing agencies and the discretionary funds, the applicable policies are observed as the framework shall have been developed. But importantly, there must be a monitoring and evaluation function that evaluates and monitors projects on a regularly basis and gives feedback to the organization, meaning the board, on a quarterly basis. But also, internally, the same monitoring and evaluation a unit should also be able to evaluate the performance of the organization in terms of the monies allocated to be spent within the organization. Let me give you a practical example. If you're spending a lot of money on ICT infrastructure to enable your processes in the organization, at some stage you may want to do a performance audit, you know, to determine whether there's value for money. Is the spend really giving you the value that you were looking for? So monitoring and evaluation would assist a great deal internally and externally, because it will check whether the intended objectives are being achieved within the set policy parameters, and internal audit will go as the third line of assurance, will also go and audit and be able to tell us if the goals are achieved. So in other words, you put in some form of what we call combined assurance or integrated assurance, which then says within the institution, management is the first line of assurance and give us those reports, which are then checked by M&E, monitoring and evaluation, risk management, to say to the board, yes, the funds are being utilized correctly, we're working within the policy parameters. But then the third line of assurance, which is more independent of management and accounts directly to the board, is your internal audit, who then goes out and give us that assurance. Bear in mind, as a board member, you can't know. You're outside. You come to a meeting. You don't even have an office there. So you rely heavily on internal audit to audit and provide independent assurance reports to the board to say, yes, policies have been followed, budget has been utilized correctly, and we can support the view that is expressed by management. And that will be corroborated by the Auditor General at the end of the financial year or during the interim audit. So there are checks and balances, there are policy frameworks, there are procedures to ensure that monies are spent. And if these are not done, consequence management will follow, will certainly follow, because once the policy parameters are there, and clear guidelines have been laid down, so everybody must work within them. to achieve the goals?
Right, I do have a question myself broadly in this area. You seem to be quite familiar with the legislation in this regard. And I know more recently, a few years back, one of the clauses was amended to facilitate proactive identification. And you've given us some good, interesting ideas about how things would be done in the community to ensure they retain sustainable development or became, as you put it, social entrepreneurs and did not become dependent. But how would you see yourself, if you were leading here, trying to facilitate this proactive? It's easy to get requests for funds. We all want money. But how do you go out and go to those communities where, in fact, they don't know how to access anything? They haven't heard about it. Thank you.
In order for the NLC to disperse these funds in a balanced, responsible way, we need to commission research first so that our funding is supported by evidence-based research. In other words, we need to really know what are the needs and challenges of the communities out there. And once those have been documented, we then need to be able to identify projects that support those needs and allocate funds correctly. Now, proactive identification can also create problems by its nature because it's not an application by a community member. It is a board identifying specific projects and deciding that they will fund those projects. And it dovetails with the issue of discretionary funds because now the funds are within the discretion of the board, how they utilize them. In order for the board not to be accused of favoritism or acting impartially or unfairly, evidence-based research of the needs of communities will support how the board distributes these funds. Because when you are accused, you can say, look, we've conducted research across the country in these provinces, and these were identified as the key needs of the communities in all of these provinces. We profiled these provinces, and based on that profiling, we have selected the following projects, and we have a criteria that we use for selection of those projects. The criteria can be developed by the board to say, this is the criteria, we followed that criteria, we followed our policy framework, we followed our procedures, and we have allocated accordingly. So it creates that balance and takes away all these suspicions of the board. Well, you raised another important question of being approached with lots and lots of applications, everybody wanting to get a fair share of the cake. There are two processes. It will be through the distribution agencies, which is the normal process. Everything, policy framework is set, everybody must meet that criteria, and it must be awarded. I think the more challenging one is this one, on the side of the board. But once you have a policy framework, procedures, you've got the criteria, and it's audited, it creates, it takes away an element of suspicion out of it, that the board is operating above board and can be trusted. And I think research and documentation of that research and the profiling of provinces and districts or regions would be critical.
Now, I really want to thank you, Mr. Humer. I'm looking at the committee. They appear to be satisfied. Do you want to raise something, Honourable Hill-Lewis?
Two brief follow-ups, if I may. Mr. Humer, thank you. Your CV shows that you are exceptionally well educated and experienced. I just want to check for my own peace of mind. Is it true that long before my time, the University of the North was referred to as Universitas Aquilonia? Was that its name?
Most universities have their Latin equivalent names at that time. Latin and the university. It's an old tradition of
Thank
many
you.
Universities.
And then one other question, if I may, Chairperson. The issue of integrity, which you have touched on, is an important one to us, obviously. The Commission and the grant-making and the distribution agencies have control over an enormous amount of funds, and the opportunities for unethical behavior are plenty. So I wonder whether you could say a bit more about how you, if you were appointed, will assure integrity in the Commission, that funds are used for their intended purposes, that they are not used for political means, that they are not used for friends and family and connected ones of those in the Commission or in the distributing agencies themselves.
Thank you. That's a tough one. And I think ethical leadership requires the board to be above board and lead by example. And establishing governance protocols, establishing policies and procedures, engaging stakeholders, publishing your criteria for evaluation of applications, allowing internal audit and the AG to audit, accounting for the funds and the performance of the institution to the executive authority, the portfolio committee, and publishing an annual report to the public and engaging stakeholders in various regions and towns of our country would assist in making our work more transparent so that everybody can ask the right questions if they have any suspicions. And also allowing a hotline where the public can raise issues through the hotline, and that hotline must be managed correctly through internal audit and directly to the board. So governance mechanisms do provide a measure of a sense of security or a sense that things will be done correctly. It's only organizations where their policies, their procedures, their frameworks are not published, their criteria for adjudicating applications are not published, or there's no mechanism to complain when your application is not successful. There's a review procedure that is in the Act. And when you allow internal audit, which is supposed to be independent, free access to any document, to any person, that in itself ensures, you know, public confidence and accountability. You allow the Auditor General to audit freely. You have a toll-free system of reporting suspicious or alleged misconduct or fraudulent activities. All those are meant to create public confidence in the institution, and those must be encouraged and maintained at all costs.
Kalaku?
No, Chair, just a question so that we reassure ourselves. It often usually happens that we interview candidates here in various committees, and you find they have not disclosed whether a person have a criminal record in the past, or whether as you were serving in the trust which was accountable to the National Lottery Board, or whether you never had any, whether sometimes allegations which were made against you by people which you have been dealing with in the trust, and even your colleagues working with. Can you make us at least comfortable around that?
Honourable Member, in your daily activities, there will be all sorts of suspicions, allegations, mistrust. And the starting principle is any allegation must be reported to the police. a case against you, then you must answer in an open court of law. But we cannot live by mistrust, gossips, malicious talks in the corridors to say this might have happened, this might not happen. All I can tell you to date, I do not have a criminal record or a criminal conviction. And I do not intend to spoil my long, hard and career. Remember, I'm an advocate of the High Court of South Africa and my fellow of the Institute of Directors. If I'm convicted of any fraud or misconduct of any nature, I'm struck off the roll immediately. And I wouldn't want to lose my certificate. I'll be struck off the roll. It's not just about being convicted of fraud. It's about any misconduct of a gross nature makes me liable. So I'm saying to you that I have not been convicted of any criminal offense. I've not appeared before any disciplinary committee and found guilty of any misconduct of any nature. Gossips, corridor talks will always be there. You know, when people don't get what they want, when you differ, some of people will always allege what they allege. But I'm saying there's proper mechanisms to, you know, to challenge those who believe there could be something against you. I mean, I've led many organizations, and people always say, hey, we don't know what these guys are doing. And I always say, take me to task. I mean, I'm there to be challenged, to be open. And I have more to lose than anybody else. I mean, who doesn't want to have the title of advocate and retain your certificate? Because that's my fallback. If anything doesn't work, I can go back to court. Or I can go to board of directors, which are more prestigious. You see? So I wouldn't want to do anything stupid.
If I may just point out to the committee, not that that excludes that question at all. We may all wish to ask it. But the process in Parliament for the appointment of boards is a security clearance, which was a two-week process. I just wanted to get the time when it actually took place. But we will get that. It took place some time ago, actually. But of course, in the interim, people may have done certain things, if I can put it that way. But having said that, I would like to thank you on behalf of the committee, Mr. Humer, for availing yourself and being here with us today. And I'm sure as you leave, you can rest assured that this committee, after today's process, will study the responses and our own notes, and then engage with each other. In short, this is not going to be just a snap decision. It is a very, very responsible position to hold. And we want to ensure that the person appointed has the integrity, the technical know-how, the commitment and the ethical approaches, and is in line with the policies of our country before we appoint. So we will consult each other and discuss this, but thank you again, and you will be informed. I'm looking at both the secretary here on my left as well as the whip. Politically, we expect to have some position to go before Parliament, which has to, of course, adopt our recommendation, and that is likely to happen in about a month, I imagine. Am I correct, Mr. Holmes? The parliamentary process. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Chairperson and honourable members, let me thank you for the opportunity. It was my first ever experience being interviewed by the parliament. It's not an easy one, but I've enjoyed it. It was tough, but it's good. I think that's what we need. We need transparency.